Hey guys, thank you so much for tuning in. If you are new, thank you so much for tuning in. And if you're with me for a while, thank you so much for coming back. I have Stephen Fry here today. He is the adorkable founder, chief brand scientist at Quantum Branding. He helps brands become authentic and memorable category leaders through the power of brand science, the core of what fuels a successful brand's growth, sales, and marketing. Stephen, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. And thank you, listeners, for joining today. So excited to be with you.
So Stephen, I don't know if you know, but I got my start as a branding strategist. Then I went into marketing. Now I have a PR marketing communications agency. So you, my friend, are someone I am super excited to talk to. But before we dive into all the fun branding and marketing stuff, tell me how you became an entrepreneur, what age and why?
Ooh, I would have to say I probably started as an entrepreneur in fourth or fifth grade. And I grew up on a farm, and my uncle had planted some Indian corn. And if you're not familiar with Indian corn, it's really pretty and it looks like little jewels. And he had just planted it and he didn't do anything with it. And I ended up selling it at the antique market at the antique show fairgrounds. And I did so good the first year, the owner of the fairgrounds or the antique show asked me to come back. And he's like, hey, I'll buy this from you. So then I sold some to him. Then I came back, had a booth, and then mine were nicer than the ones I gave to him because I had put some like, you know, cray paper ribbons on it. And I sold it for three times as much. So then we've probably got some, you know, macrame hemp necklaces in grade six. But following all the way up to adulthood, I started my agency in 2004. And it's been a wild ride ever since.
I love that so much. So I see what you did with the bows. That in itself was a way to brand the corn. I love that so much. So
premiumization of Indian corn. That's a chapter in one of my upcoming books, I'm sure.
I love that so much. So let's dive into maybe someone's listening and they're looking to start a company. Tell them what your definition of branding is.
Sure. So it's really it can be really, really daunting when you're starting out. And I want to simplify it for you and for the listeners and anybody who's listening. When you think about it back in the day, you maybe would have traded, you know, some cheese for some wheat, and there would have been a little sign by the blacksmith's door. And so how did you know whom to trade with? There literally was, you know, signs. And so marketing is an evolution of that. It literally is a way that we promote the functional trade. So fast forward, we're in a digital global economy. You don't make cell phones. I don't make cars. How do we know whom to work with? So people market and they share, say, hey, do business with me in all different ways, whether it's online, it's digital, it's print, it's, you know, text messages now, people trying to buy my house. You know, it's all those things that say, hey, do business with me. And then branding is the stuff within marketing that makes you remember it. And so then I actually work within brand science, which is the study of how do we make that branding more memorable? How do we make you remember that one specific company and make you think of them first? So there's kind of three tiers to it. You know, first is your business. And then there's you sharing, hey, do business with me. And then there's, you know, the branding elements, the distinct word, shape, color, typefaces, sounds, music, story, photography, illustrations, any of these sensory things that you experience. Not many brands have smells. People would advocate maybe colognes, or sometimes there's hotels that, you know, put scents into the hotel. But for the most part, it's all of those sensory categories that I just mentioned. And so the way to get people to think of you first is to create memories. So the goal is to create memories using those sensory objects in your marketing so that they think of you first.
So that's kind of like Mark Gobi's emotional branding, the science that he created 20 years ago, I would say. You know, you're taking branding to the emotional aspect of the psychology of it. So with that being said, and this is totally my favorite topic because I started as a brand strategist before I became a publicist. And my question to you is, and I'm sure I know the answer, but the listeners probably don't. So every industry has color of psychology. Can you walk me through that?
Sure. So I want to just debunk, and I love that you brought up Mark Gobi. So he's really pointing to trying to create a new paradigm for connecting with brands. And but what's interesting is that's just one component, and he's kind of laser focused. When it comes to psychology, it's very interesting because we would like, when we go on blogs, say, just let's simplify this. When you go on a blog and you're like, what color should I make my brand? So you type it in and you're like, blue means clean. Well, blue may not mean clean. Blue may mean winter mint in kind of the dental or the candy category. Yellow may not be happy. It may mean stained teeth in the dental industry. You know, so colors are subject to what we call cultural contextualism. Literally just the context you experience, category or an industry. So every industry is going to have their norms. It's almost like baseball. Like if there's first base and there's third base, these are kind of the boundaries of first base is what the customer is looking for and expects. So we go down the cookie aisle and they're like, ooh, you know, French blue, or like for French vanilla is blue, you know, raspberry is kind of pink. So we have these dessert colors, but they're also in the cookie aisle. And so they're like, oh, well, Oreo is blue, but then all sandwich cookies are blue. And then there's like trade dress. So there's crunchy, cookie, gluten-free ingredients, customer cues. And then there's industry cues of just how they do packaging. You know, shrink wrap stuff is down on the bottom. Stuff in trays that slide out sideways is in the middle. Bougie top shelf cookies are literally on the top shelf at eye level. They're a premium and they're in parchment cups and bags, whether it's Tate's or Pepperidge Farms. So there's industry norms. And then there's just, what are people looking for? Oh, I'm looking for a chocolate chip cookie. Oh, I'm looking for a shortbread cookie. Oh, I'm looking for a soft chewy cookie with peanut butter chunks in it. So every category is like this metaphor. Even if you're a service category, you still have category norms with your customers of what they're looking for. So everyone shares these. So then it's up to you. You get to decide, where do I hit the ball? So if you notice that in this metaphor, Tate's does this and Oreo does that, do you want to try to signal what they're doing and mimic it and just be a low-cost leader version of that? Or do you want to be distinct? So I would want to be distinct. And I say distinct because we don't want to be different. Because if you're different, your cake, your pie, your crackers, your chips, you're not a cookie anymore. You're not a dental provider. You're not a tech startup. So you have to play within the boundaries of your category and find out what those norms are with the colors. So all the way back from once the rabbit trail came, you're asking about the psychology of color. The best way to make a decision about color in your category is actually do the brand research and find out everybody in your industry and then the tangent industries. Know how I mentioned like desserts and cookies? So you may have like the bakery, but then you may have creamer over here because they may share some of those shared memories. It's actually called semiotics. Semiotics is like the little boxes we put stuff in our brains. It's one of the foundational sciences of brain science that I use. And it's a way that we organize things like a March Madness bracket or like a little tiny Russian doll that nests and nests. So I could say, hey, Jackie, go to the fridge and think of something that's white, that's in the door, that's a condiment, that's in a jar. And then I'll throw you for a loop on this one and say, that's a vegetable. And you're like, oh, whoa, what? I was on mayo for a second, you know, and most of us are thinking mayo, oh, white. And we went milk, ooh, eggs, ooh, sour cream, you know, someone went sour cream. But what's funny is the boxes that we make are always specific to the locale that we are. So when we do our research, the semiotics of how those boxes works are local and then regional and then national and then international. So what we may find out is coffee brands, when they're small, may be certain colors. But then when we look at coffee brands that are big, over 95% of them are a shade of red. I didn't see that coming internationally. I just thought they were all green. Well, we live in a microcosm and we don't know the history of maybe Starbucks and why they made that choice. And then there was Green Valley, you know, Green Mountain Valley Coffee and all these other ones that came out and kind of followed suit. So in the end, the choices we make with color are highly dependent on finding out, like, what are the pre-existent memories? What are the other people using? We don't want to signal them. And we also want to say the right thing. So there's a lot at play. So you really want to have an award-winning kind of like, you know, grand slam hit with the colors you choose because you want to be distinct. So when people see you, they can associate you with that color in that category. So that was a long-winded answer, but that was like as short as possible as I could make it.
That's amazing. That's okay. I love this. I'm a branding, marketing nerd. So this is like right up my alley. So let's say someone already has, you know, their brand elements, their logo, their color. Sure. How do they know that it's set up for success? Like, what would you say, like, is a company set up for success versus, hey, maybe we should do a rebrand?
Sure. So I get this question a lot because a lot of people think the common myth is that and you don't know what you don't know. So a lot of people believe that branding is an activity that's done once and done. It's like I got married. Well, you still have to date, you still have to communicate, you still have to, the same thing with your business. There's an initial branding activity, and that involves a lot of strategy typically. But here's the interesting fact. The majority of brands out there are operating with not enough distinctive brand assets. And distinctive brand assets are those things that I was talking about. You know, your tagline, your typefaces that you use. Don't say the word fonts. Fonts means it's the file. So just that's why we say typefaces. So you've got your brand mark, you've got your color, you've got your typefaces. You may have a tagline. But then that's usually about it. But then when you look at Fortune 500 brands, how many distinctive brand assets do they have? Coca-Cola has over 150. And what they do is they manipulate and they refresh them. So you may see the same Coke Zero can. This was not intentional, but I just brought it up. So Coca-Cola 10 years ago had a black can for, I call it Coke Zero, I call it Man Coke. So, you know, Man Coke had footballs on it when it's football season because they're trying to create associations. They want you to associate it with tailgating with your friends. Maybe there's beach balls on it in the summer, but they're refreshing it so that when you see it, it looks new and you notice it. And that's actually the whole first step. That's the whole first step that we want people to do is notice us. But here's the interesting thing. Coke Zero and Coca-Cola has over 150 distinctive brand assets. You know, their tagline, the shape of the bottle, the polar bears. I think one year they added penguins, there's Santa Claus. And so seasonally, they're refreshing and they're still distinct. It's still the same typeface. It's still the same colors, but it's just updated and refreshed every so often so that they can stay top of mind. Back to us, we have our color, our brand mark, our typefaces, our tagline. That's four. Even if Michelangelo or one of the great Ninja Turtle artists themselves actually developed your brand mark for you, you know, even if Stefan Sagmeister created just one brand mark for you or somebody famous, that's just one thing. And then compared to a slew of 150 sensory memories, it's going to be really, really difficult for you to move forward as a brand. So the goal is, maybe your first initial activity was great. It was strategic. Count how many you have. And I actually have a checklist and happy to give this away. It's the brand science checklist. And it just helps people walk through how to count their distinctive brand assets. It's really easy. It's at bit.ly/brand science checklist. So I'll send that over. But bit.ly/brand science checklist. I can't even say the name.
I'll just put it in the show notes and make it easy.
Well, put it in the show notes. But the idea is you want to count these up. And the idea is you want to count them up and you want them to be two things, distinct and famous. And now your brand may not be famous enough yet. So the one thing that you can check is you can check how distinct it is. So some of the questions you can just ask yourself is, hey, when I look at the color of my brand, does it signal my category? Is everyone else this color? Is someone else this exact same color? Or does this cue my competitors? Does this cue a competitor? Or is it really, really unique? I just finished up a rebrand custom house builder in Texas. And their whole category locally, there in Brenham, in the Burton area, was blue. So what we decided to do was pick a very, very kind of antique navy cadet blue and then focus the accent being this like rustic gold, like a tannish gold. And then we made filigrees, and the whole concept was in a very kind of barnhouse chic custom house market. They were quality and integrity. So we've got some filigrees and we got typefaces that establish that kind of that concept. You look at it, you're like, man, it looks like that's like from like ye old mercantile down the street, like a, you know, so it conjured, the psychology conjured up that. So we grounded the color for them in the category, which was blue, because that was in the context of their neighborhood, the most common one. So it rooted it, but the accent color was their main color. That help drive the distinctiveness. So at the end of the day, we want to test first, how many do we have, and consider growing that. So if we have 3 to 5, we want to work on having 5 to 10. We initially want to have about 15 to 20 to start. And then each quarter, be looking at how can we advance this with maybe another distinctive sensory asset in another area. So maybe you have great colors. Okay, awesome. What if this next quarter you worked on creating 3 to 5 distinctive like photography shots that you just used all the time of you, people using your product? Now, if it doesn't have to be the people's faces. It could be the close-up. It could be editorial style, fuzzy. You know, everyone's got editorial on their phone now. So it could be photography. It could be illustrations. Just I worked on a project and it was an iced tea seltzer. And so we used illustrations of tea leaves in the background for the sweet tea, peaches for the peach, lemon for each of the flavors. There was a custom illustration. Why? Because we can't own a picture of an orange or a strawberry or a berry. So then when you think about that, folks like Truly, you know, they're doing a great job, they're succeeding, but they're missing an opportunity when they use just photography of fruit, because nobody can own photography of fruit. Like, unless they stacked it up and made a little creature out of it and it looked cute, I don't know. But like, the idea is that we want it to be distinct. So when people see that, they think of you. So first count how many you have. And then, you know, you really want to get to having at least 20 in all 7 categories. You know, sound and music are kind of the ones you may not get to, you know, if you're not doing broadcast, if you're not doing, you know, apps, you know, so the main ones you're going to want to check out, you're going to want to check out color, you're going to want to check out word, you're going to want to check out story, you're going to want to check out shape. So everything from archetype to in your messaging strategy, to photography, to illustrations, to icons. But here's the thing, icons, you don't want to take away and be the main show. They're just like guiding elements you may see. So all of these together are meant to conjure up this big nest of associations. It's almost like a spider web. Like, and that's probably not the best metaphor, but when you think of it, it's like a cluster in our brain. It's called nodes. So if I just met Jackie at an event, if I just met you and I saw you wear these dangly earrings, I'd be like, oh, dangly earrings, Jackie, cute shirt, great hair. I'm making all these associations. So I've got 4 memories about Jackie that are in my mind. And so then every time I see you, I'm building more and more memories to those. And so in my mind, I'm building more nodes. Well, the same thing with brands. The more sensory assets we have, the more memories we're creating. And the reason that works is because we have system one and system two thinking. And our brains, 95% of the time, are on this sensory autopilot, just gathering information about the world around us. So the more sensory assets we make, the more memories we make, the more memories we make about someone or something, the bigger the nodes are. And it's like a dirt road versus a highway. It's like, mm-hmm. which one's easier and faster? Your brain's going to want to go on the nicer, faster road. So this is called neuroplasticity. So we have the option to change this. We can help change if the perception of our brand isn't good. We can change that by focusing on changing the perception and increasing the associations we have. Because at the end of the day, the brand that has, and if you haven't started putting the threads together, the brand that has the most top of mindness is the one that you think of first and then the one that you purchase.
So it's pretty much the consumer experience. You know, I'll share with you, I branded a dog grooming company that now has over 20 locations. And we really went for what kind of experience are they going to have when they walk in, right? Versus you're just walking into a mom and shop local dog groomers, you know, it may not be branded. So you're not having that experience where we really wanted to have an experience. So we chose specific colors. We kind of wanted to make it the Apple of grooming because Apple did an amazing job with the experience, right? Everything you just spoke about. So I want to play a quick hot seat game with you, if that's okay.
Love hot seats.
Because I love branding and I want to hear your take on it.
Do we need to get out the bell? I have a bell. We have a, I don't know. We're going to use the bell.
Yes, we could use the bell. Why not? Let's have some fun. So I'm going to put, let's say 30 seconds on the clock. Let me just get out the clock really quickly. And in 30 seconds, the clock, I'm going to ask you to tell me some of your favorite brands based on their branding. So is 30 seconds enough or is it too much? Or ready?
Okay. No, that's fine. I have to think.
Well, that's why it's a game. Because then, just so you know, I don't want to give away the game. So we'll go with 30 seconds. Name your favorite brands. Don't give me reasons yet. Just logos. Think okay. of like logos. Ready, set, go.
Okay. Coke Zero, Lindt, Pete's Coffee, Penguin Books. Which I think Bonobos Pants.
5 seconds.
I can't think of any more.
Buzzer. We need the buzzer.
Time's up.
Amazing. Okay. So I have those in mind, but now I'm going to give you another 30 seconds. And now you're going to tell me brands that you would love to rebrand. Ready? Ready, set, go.
Pepsi.
Oh, we'll talk about that.
Pepsi, Microsoft. Walmart. Harbor Freight Tools. Home Depot.
5 seconds.
Taco Bell.
And done. That was so fun. Okay, so let's talk about that for a second because you said Pepsi. I want to ask you why before I get into it really quickly.
Sure. So here's the interesting thing. It's hard for me.
Because they just did a rebrand. Based on consumer psychology, which is interesting. Or so they say.
I was on a podcast that also featured the CEO of Pepsi. So I'm gonna daintily dance around this one.
Oh, so am I because I won't so say, but yeah. Thing.
No one, and I'm looking at you, camera, user, reader, listener, reader, watcher. no one should ever just rebrand something because they don't like it. Do your research. So this is a hypothetical magic situation. Let the professionals just make believe for a second. So okay. I would say Pepsi because here's why. I believe that the rebrand failed to acknowledge the distinctive memory structures that were previously established in the kind of Cindy Crawford's, you know, vending machine era that was the red and the blue. The best brands actually evolve and develop the distinctive memory structures of their brand. And so it updates it in a way that is fresh, but also nostalgic. So using the typeface, using the brand mark, you know, when Nissan just redid theirs, and, you know, Kia did theirs in a different direction, but Nissan is a good example where they used primarily the same shape of the typeface, the same shape of the crest to acknowledge the brand. And if you look at any iconic brands that have been more around, over time, they update. Why? Because the way we learn, the way we read, the way we process information, the environment, all the context of the way the brand is experienced shifts a little bit. And then we also learn things that we shouldn't be doing sometimes. But at the end of the day, Pepsi is a great example because I don't believe they actually have enough distinctive brand assets comparatively to Coca-Cola. I think if the last time I did this where I counted them up, I think they were in the 15 to 20 mark. And then they even created variations of the brand mark itself based on like different flavors that they had was like a different smile, like the little shape was smiling even more. So there was inconsistencies in the application of the brand mark. And then, you know, some of the colors themselves, like, yes, kind of red may denote cola. And then so does red and blue. And as a result of them being in the market. But really, other than the typeface of Pepsi and the brand mark and the colors, there's really not a lot of distinctive brand assets. They've relied a lot on celebrities and commercials to create associations. But if you didn't watch that commercial at the Super Bowl, you know, with the guy from The Office, I forget his name, but if you didn't watch it, the one way back when with Cindy Crawford, you know, Steve Carell, if you don't watch that commercial, is Pepsi okay? Pepsi's more than okay. And then they kind of clapped back a little bit. Then what? So there really wasn't much structure to that campaign that offered more distinctive brand assets other than celebrities. So comparatively, when I look at Coca-Cola, they're dominating the distinctive, you know, brand assets game in their category, you know, from all the every sensory category. And then Pepsi just doesn't perform. Pepsi doesn't have enough to drive that. Now, here's the thing. They have the flip side of this, mental availability and physical availability. So the brand with the most physical availability or mental availability is the one that you go to purchase physically. So they have Yum brands, they have distribution, they have Taco Bell, they have all the you know, restaurants that they have. So they have the physical availability side of things. So their top of mindness necessarily isn't as important or may not be the driving factor when distribution is what, you know, in all the restaurants that they have there. So that's why I would do that. And I would say the same thing to the CEO of Pepsi. It would be an interesting conversation to hear their perspective on that and share with them that tenet of brand science in kind of...
So what are some things, without getting too detailed, that you would love to see Home Depot? I do think they need a, and this is an interesting question. Do you think they just haven't rebranded or done much marketing because they're pretty much just a company that's always in need? People are always, you know, going to buy.
Shoot from the hip on this one and try to keep it 30,000 foot view. I believe that the majority of Home Depot's consumers are kind of the weekend go-getters. In my understanding, Home Depot is kind of the Walmart of building supplies. You know, they're driving high volume, low prices. They have a contractor's entrance. You can do the Home Depot Pro. They've got programs tailored to helping professionals in the construction industry. And you can even, if you don't have a job, you can hang out in the parking lot in the morning and someone may offer you work for the day because there's that many people going to Home Depot early in the morning to get supplies for their projects and things. So they're predominantly, in my understanding, their customer is looking for best price, contractor, you know, professional. Here's the thing, big picture, I would love for any brand out there, and you can take this away with your Home Depot or not. When we zero in on one type of customer, we actually complicate it and we make a big deal about it. We make too big a deal about saying there's one type of customer for us. So what we actually want, brand science offers us a perspective that says, how can my brand grow in a low risk way? So if we focus on creating a customer avatar that's so defined by their demographics or their job or their title, instead of how we can help them, we miss an opportunity. So the idea is that we want to make our brand available to all buyers, as many buyers as possible. The person that would only go there once a year for a Christmas tree, to the person that would go there every morning to pick up supplies, to the person that's going to do, go there every other weekend. So I think one of the big opportunities with, and why I would say Home Depot, is I would want them to appeal to more customers in a sales frequency. So light, mild, moderate, and heavy, instead of just construction heavy, have a wider range of appeal. And that's actually a brand science principle. We want to make it easy for people to understand who we are, what we do, why it matters, and make it easy for them to get us. Like, what is it you do? Like, oh, underwater basket weaving for otters. Yes. You know, ice cream and waffle store. Yes. You know, construction supplies. Yes. So we want to make it easy for them to get what we do and then invite them into opportunities to purchase on a variety of sales frequencies.
Well, what would you say? Because, you know, a marketing guru can argue to what you just said and say, well, how do we target our audience if we don't get niche specific? So what would you say to someone who's in marketing who says, well, Home Depot is what it's for? Why would we want to promote waffles at Home Depot?
Oh, I was just using examples of other types of companies. If they have waffles at Home Depot, it could be just a, you know, like,
well, they've tried, well, they did the hot dog thing. So that's why I was like, you know, they used to give,
there's,
they used to have the
that,
hot dog.
That lady outside the door at mine, she's always wanting to put celery salt, and I recommend it. I highly recommend put the celery salt on.
But, you know, it's to what you just said, whether it's waffles or anything, you said you want to make it, you know, more, I guess you broad.
Universal.
Yes.
Universal.
So to a marketing person, they would say, no, quite the opposite. We want to target the right consumer to keep coming through the door. So what would you say to that?
Sure. So what's interesting is the background of brand science, and I'm not the only one in the brand science camp. Folks like Dr. Byron Sharp, Jenny Romaniuk, there's a lot of PhD, you know, level folks. There's people at WashU in St. Louis. There's a lot of people trying to share and promote the science behind marketing. And they could probably feel that question more intuitively and academically than I can. But I'll pull from my repository of things that I know to be true. In the science of marketing, which is how does effective marketing work? I'm like a subset of how to make the brand assets work. But in this larger subset that I'm part of, marketing is meant to get people's attention, create memories, and then drive traffic. It's meant to promote trade and help convert that into trade. So we're addressing perception, we're influencing behavior. The interesting thing that both marketing and branding, doesn't matter what department you are, whether it's operations or sales, the one thing that's interesting is that we all are competing against each other, regardless of whether you are a luxury brand or whether you're an economy brand, in our minds, because your mind actually only has one kind of, it doesn't have a luxury and economy box. So all brands compete against all brands in their category. And then they also compete against all brands their same size. And the reason this is because if you wanted to move the needle, and Byron Sharp talks about this in his book, How Brands Grow. And he talks about his fictitious example is Crest versus Colgate, and how you would want to, you know, the fictitious scenario he creates is, how do we get more? Well, we need to target loyal switchers, and we need to show how we're different. And at the end, he says, all that seems like intuitive of what you should do, but actually, it's not going to move the needle much, because in this scenario, Crest has 72% of the market and you only have 10. you're not going to be able to. And then he goes through and he debunks some of the other fallacies throughout the book, like how loyalty programs don't work unless they were actually in someone else's store, you know, is what he suggests. So at the end of the day, the challenge is you are in a category competing against everybody else. So whether you're Louis Vuitton or your Coach, most people don't realize Coach used to be sold at Walmart. It's just, that's neither here nor there. That's not a slam against them, but the distribution model that they used, that's how they got popular. So when you're trying to appeal to your customers, it's typically the higher level motivation that what you're trying to connect with them about of what you do, like Simon Sinek's golden circle. He says, here's the what you do. Here's the how you do it. And then here's the why. Like, why are you doing? So that's where you get into archetypes and these intrinsic motivators of, do I want stuff that is beautiful and creative and artisanal? Then I may go to this boutique landscaping company to get my plants. I may not go to Home Depot, because the big concept that I have behind Home Depot is that they're this everyman, you know, everyday pricing. But if my motivator is something that is different from that, I may gravitate towards down a different path. So the challenge for brands is really to get more customers, is to be more universal. And that actually seems to go against what we're taught. But the unfortunate part is what we're taught often isn't the empirical truth of how marketing works. And so there's a lot of leaders and folks who are talking about marketing and how it works. And it's kind of like learning about the birds and the bees on the back of the bus. Like, it's well-intended. It's what they know. And this is not a slam to any of the thought leaders. There's a lot of great theories and there's a lot of great ways to execute. At the end of the day, I can only, you know, sit with this, you know, the brand science side and the empirical side and look at, you know, does this actually move the needle? And so when we're looking at moving the needle for a brand, the needle moves the most with distinctive brand assets, making the brand universal and for us noticing, being attracted to it and getting what they do.
Yes. So you sound like someone who's super busy in your life, especially your work life. So do you believe in, and if so, how do you manage work-life balance?
Ooh, so this is a great question. And people like to talk about it. I don't think of what I do as work. I think 20% of the time there's stuff, I don't know if we can cuss on here, but there's stuff that I don't want to do about 20% of the time. My goal is to live and work in, you know, an 80% flow state of things I love. You know, if there's another rubric, you know, we talked about, you know, fame and distinctiveness, you know, there's another one of joy and skill. Like, do I like it, but am I good at it? Like, I want to stay up here in this quadrant of things I'm good at and enjoy for my work. Now, there may be things that I'm not good at, but enjoy. Those are hobbies. So I do those and I don't try to make money off of them. But the goal for me is to have, you know, boundaries and healthy relationships in every part of my life. And there's not like, this is home and this is work, and I need to shut off and become a different individual. I don't know that I, it's hard to describe. Like, putting in a really, really long day isn't going to make me feel better when I come home and relaxed and at home and make me a better person to be with Mr. Peanut Butter and the other cats that I rescue and Onyx, my service dog, and the friends and the families that I'm with. So, the end goal, yes, I want to, you know, pay the bills, you know, buy the top shelf cat food for them, you know, enjoy the things that I enjoy, at Cook Zero, you know, but never at an expense to myself. And I think that's a more recent lesson. In the past, you know, 5-10 years, I thought working harder would get me farther faster. And in the end of it, I was just a very lonely person, just staying up late, working hard all the time for clients who didn't appreciate. So those healthy boundaries of saying when I'm available, when I'm not available, doesn't mean anything to the client. Doesn't mean I don't love them or serve them any less. It just means I'm not available at that time. And the structure that I devote to saying like, okay, twice a week, I'm going to play volleyball. I'm going to garden outside for 20 minutes. Those things, I create those rituals that are important because those nourish me and, you know, fill me back up. So I believe it's a combination of boundaries, healthy communication, just checking in with yourself. Like, where am I at right now? Oh, I'm really frustrated today. I don't want to do this. Okay. What do I need to do to shift that? So being present first in yourself, showing up for yourself and how you show up for yourself then helps how you show up for others. So work-life balance, that's kind of like, I don't think that's a, like, it's not a switch. It's not like, oh, we put work here and we put life, like all of it is life. Like, if that makes sense, it's like spaghetti. It's like there's spaghetti and then there's like, and the, you know, there's Parmesan cheese hobbies on top. And then there's sauce, which is work, but the bones is like family and life and friends is the spaghetti. Like, it's all together, you know.
Now we're going to want spaghetti.
Now we're going to want spaghetti. Oh.
But, you know, to that point, you know, if there's a young entrepreneur listening, I do think, especially for beginner entrepreneurs, they have this hard time knowing the difference between productivity and being busy. Like, if you're productive, you know, like if you prioritize tasks, you can get so much done in 3 hours, sure. Right? And sure. Then, you know, you balance your hobbies, your life or whatnot versus being busy and just, you know, going from task to task to task to task because you don't actually know what you're doing. So anyone listening to really, I don't want to say master because I feel like as humans, we're constantly evolving, period. But to get better as an entrepreneur, that work-life balance really comes down to being more productive. Right. So you actually get yourself more time.
Sure. And I would even say prioritize.
Yeah.
You're saying that as well. You're saying prioritize. You know, Gary Keller has the book, The One Thing. And he's like, what's the one thing you need to do today? You don't have to buy the book unless you want to. You can't. But that's the main concept he talks about in all these other ways. But Gary W. Keller says, you know, the one thing, what is the one thing you need to do today to move your business forward? You know, so for different industries, this is different. So for you, it may be, I need to get this project off my plate today for move forward. For a salesperson, it may be, I need to smile and dial or do sales for the first part of my day. And if you're an entrepreneur, it may be a combination of those things to say like, okay, am I focusing on revenue generating activities or activities that are going to move my business forward today? You know, or am I just playing revising my website? Over and over and over. Am I doing a thing that feels important? It feels important to me because I care so much about it. But in the reality, is it actually going to help you get traction? You know, so the goal is, what's the one thing that you're going to do today that's going to move your business forward? And I would say another book that's really great, Elizabeth Gilbert, Big Magic. I think that's the name of it. Yes, Big Magic, Elizabeth Gilbert. And she talks about her friend, Brené Brown, and how Brené Brown used to, in these like sacrificial artist way, like, I'm going to go away in my artist in my pain, and I'm going to isolate and I'm going to work on my stuff. And then she talks about, wait, what if the starving artist and the hurting artist idea is wrong? Like, what if we actually create and do things in concert with people? And she talks about how Brené Brown will take some of her girlfriends and walk through the content of her book. And so doing your business, are you doing it in concert with other people? Or are you just trying to, like, are you just this like tiny satellite? Like, when are you going to orbit? Or are you in an orbit with other people that are revolving around you that are going to help pull you into their gravitation and help pull you to where you want to be with your business? So those are just some things that I think of as I hear you share that.
That is so true, you know, because I go into companies all the time and they're constant. And you said something so funny, which I've seen so many times. People are constantly in the middle of updating. You always hear, I got to update my website, or let's update the website. I'm like, that's not going to, you know, change anything. Like, what's the strategy? You know, what are we trying to do to get, like, updating your website's not going to, you know, get you a return on your investment unless you have a strategy behind it, right?
I blame that movie, If You Build, Field of Dreams, If You Build It, They Will Come. That's great when you're talking about ghosts in that movie, but when you're talking about your website, like, just having a website and changing and making better, like, if you're not driving people to it, they're not just going to come to it. So that, like, we love to pick and choose our little colloquialisms. And that's one of them. Oh, if we build it, they will come, you know? So like the lead funnel is great, but if there's no reason to drive them there and they're not, you know, they're not going to get it. So yeah, I'm right there with you.
I love that. So you have a 10-week program. So anyone listening, I'm sure they learned so much from you today. But let's say someone was interested to work with you. What could they find inside that 10-week program?
Sure. So the 10-week program is called Brandpreneur. And Brandpreneur is a way that I am turning the marketing model of working with agencies and clients upside down. So traditionally, most people will approach a marketing agency and they will come up with a plan, but that plan is typically based on their understanding of your business, their products, their pricing, their profitability, and it's actually about their product. So what I want to do is I want brand leaders, whether you're a CMO, a CEO, a senior brand leader, senior brand officer, chief brand officer, chief digital officer, if you're in charge of your brand, I want to equip you with a plan that you know what is next for the agent stage of your business and how to move your brand forward faster. So the first 6 weeks, we learn about just the major tenets of brand science. So it's like football analogy, conditioning and training. We're just going to learn the basics. Then there's a 4-day workshop where we actually work on creating the plan. So it's like it's like game day. So then we get game day. And then we create that plan. So you're creating an assessment for your brand and what the next steps are on kind of a 90-day sprint calendar. And then the last 4 weeks, we're walking through some of the strategies and plays that are specific to you that you're going to want to watch out for. So whether that's cognitive biases, just different strategies and things that in the marketplace that you don't know about. But like, wouldn't you want to know that the other team is going to make this play? Don't you want to win the Super Bowl? Don't you want to be the leader in your category? So the goal is to, over 10 weeks, help you understand just enough of the basics so that you can come back with a plan to walk through with your team and you know what's next. So you'll know whether you need to focus more on, you know, bolstering your brand, your distinctive brand assets. You'll know whether you need to work on your brand strategy or your platform or work on going to the next stage and testing out some of those before you can kind of go from traction to growth to scale to authority. We want to make sure that you have the right brand platform. So I'm equipping leaders to propel them towards industry authority using brand science by coming up with that brand plan. And then we can continue to choose to work together, either on their brand assets or the brand strategy, or they can just go and implement that on their own. But the goal is to help them understand and self-assess what is next for me, how do I get the most success, and how do I protect my ROI as a brand leader, the marketing things that I'm investing in. How do I know the choices that I'm making are the right ones? And so kind of the flip side of it, I'm helping provide confidence and clarity. I want people to be confident and securely seated in their role, knowing that they're making the right choices or the best choices at the moment. And they can always pivot and tack and make another choice afterwards.
I love that so much. And that also, guys, will be in the show notes for anyone listening and interested. So, Stephen, I have my final question. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
I had to make it dramatic. Sorry. So, Stephen, okay. Knowing everything you know now, what would you tell your younger self?
Oh, I would tell my younger self, be gentle with yourself and gracious. I would be gracious to myself and also tell my younger self, hold on, kid, you haven't seen anything yet. Keep dreaming.
I love that so much. That is so true. Be so gentle with yourself. I feel like we're always putting ourselves under so much pressure, and it always works out. When you surrender, I always say, the moment you're scared, just surrender. That means lean in more into surrender. So I love that. Stephen, go ahead.
you said when you notice, and I was like, that's a powerful word, actually, notice, like noticing. So when you notice, say, oh, I'm noticing. What am I noticing? A friend of mine says that. Go ahead.
It's the awareness. Yes. So Stephen, where can everybody find you on social media?
So on social media, I'm on Facebook, but you can also, we're going to, in the show notes, have my link tree is the easiest one. You can watch my award-winning talk. You can check me out at quantumbranding.agency, or you can check me out at LinkedIn, or you can shoot me a message at Quantum Branding and say, hey, I have a question. Tell me more about this. But on my link tree, there's also a spot where you can download that brand science checklist and that's not a salesy thing. That's a tool that's built over 15 years of brand science research. And that is going to help you get forward faster. And, you know, my goal is to work myself out of a job. I want so many people to know about brand science and how branding actually works that you don't need me anymore. And I can go retire in some lake house near a mountain someplace.
That's the goal. Well, Stephen, thank you so much for being here with us today.
Thank you for having me. And thank you, listeners, for joining.